Gurave Gaurachandraya Radhikaya Tadale Krishnaya Krishna Bhaktaya Tat Bhaktaya Namo Namaha. So, good morning to all of you. Welcome. Thank you so much for your presence and for your ears and hearts, which no doubt are very important contributing factor to this whole equation. So I appreciate it. And today we are in our third lecture of our series called Radical Personalism. Third lecture. So today we will be speaking about the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. But as usual, let's make first a brief recap of last week's meeting about holy shift, upgrading our Gaudiya paradigm, where we basically introduced this idea of shift or change or paradigm shift in connection to the willingness to be transformed and to rethink our different, whatever necessary patterns may be there to readjust. Interestingly, the word repent means rethink, although sometimes we understand it differently. So all this has to do with being willing to adjust and change our angle of vision. In that connection, we invoke the term sambandha, which also has a lot to do with this, not only with the receiving of certain knowledge, but with the how about that receiving, how we are receiving, how we are conceiving, how we are chewing, ruminating the knowledge that comes to us, and how to recognize all the different filters and patterns that need to be addressed that may obstruct the proper flow of divine transmission. And we mentioned also how when this sambandha is properly in place, abhideya, prayojan follow as a natural byproduct. So in some way, they are extensions of the principle of sambandha properly in place. So by this type of sambandha, by this embrace of paradigm shift, we are invited to participate, if you will, in a movement or to create a movement or to continue developing a movement. And we mentioned how this movement is always in terms of inner movement to begin with. That may take any external form in time, but the movement always starts in the heart. Even if we are 2-3 like-minded fellows, that's enough for having a movement in place. It's not about big institutions or big whatever managerial arrangements. That can be, cannot be, but the actual movement is something that begins from the heart. As we always invoke the idea of Mahaprabhu being himself starting his own movement like a volcano erupting, but something was moving in his heart first. Whatever took shape externally after that, that's a natural byproduct. So we belong to that type of movement, to that type of living school. That's how we define the idea of Sampradaya, as a living school of living prophets or living mystics. We spend some time speaking about the meaning of being a prophet or even a mystic in a way that is more relatable for our particular situation, and it's so for sure totally real and substantial. And basically, as we mentioned, a mystic or a prophet will be someone who is willing to keep the pace with transcendence, because transcendence is ever-evolving, ever-expanding. And if we belong to a school that points to transcendence, our school should reflect those same values, and we as members of it. And of course, by contrast, we analyze what's the opposite of that, when religion is even used to hide or to deny what needs to be changed, to deny the pattern, to deny the paradigm shift, if you will, that needs to be addressed. So it's important that we, as members of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, we prepare, we prevent, we face voluntarily whatever needs to be acknowledged for us to continue in this ongoing participation in the living school of living prophets, Gaudiya Sampradaya. And we concluded last class with a brief section that somehow today will overflow into today's class, the idea of the Kumar Lila of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. If we were to conceive of our living school as a living being with all its corresponding developmental stages and considering when the Sampradaya began from Mahaprabhu or even more recently how it began in the West a few decades ago, we could rightfully speak about the Gaudiya Sampradaya being in its Kumar Lila or in its infancy, in its very beginning, like a newborn baby, if you will, as a tradition. Which, of course, there's nothing to bad to say about that. A baby is beautiful, baby is charming, especially because of the potential that a baby, all the potential that is concentrated in that little entity, all the vulnerability that that entity presents, properly understood, although things are charming by themselves. But at the same time, that vulnerability to turn into empowerment and not being abused requires proper environment, proper nourishing, proper guidance. That potential for it to be actualized needs also proper guidance, like a baby. A baby cannot be left by himself or herself. So parents have to be there taking care. So in the same way, we as members of the Sampradaya, it's not that we are necessarily the parents of the Sampradaya, but if we want to conceive from a historical perspective the baby-like situation of the Sampradaya, we have to take care in service to that ideal. Or if we are the baby instead, if you want to turn to embed, feel more comfortable with you feeling yourself the baby, well, then we have lots to do to to go through that stage and eventually grow into a full-blown adult and elder, ideally. Not only remain consumers of the Sampradaya, consumers of the product, but also ask ourselves, and we concluded our previous lecture with that. That was, if I'm not mistaken, like the homework or like the collective reflection we were invited to participate in, to ask ourselves, what does Krishna consciousness expect from me? Instead of asking the question, what do I expect from Krishna consciousness? So what is that higher realm expecting from me, and how can I contribute in a healthy way? So that said, leaving at that point, today we will continue unpacking more of these points or the implications of this question, if you will. Somehow, the question that comes at the end of one class kind of starts we're trying to reply that throughout the week and through the next class, like a natural overflow. So today, then we arrive to today's class, third lecture of our series of Radical Personalism, where we will be speaking about the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, continuing with the idea of conceiving of the Sampradaya as a unit, as a personality, Radical Personalism. Everything has its own personality. So the Gaudiya Sampradaya, in connection to today's title, also has a collective unconscious. So let's try to unpack this notion. So this idea of the unconscious, which I imagine you are familiar with, and somehow could be paralleled to the notion of citta in our Gaudiya tradition, or in the Hindu tradition, in yogic literature. Citta has to do with, as you know, this like storehouse with different impressions are there. But the notion of the unconscious in particular is a very interesting contribution coming from Carl Jung, famous psychologist, and basically refers to that, like citta again, to that invisible storehouse where unlimited impressions, acquired impressions, samskaras we may call them, lie. They lie there and they inform most of our present movements. Of course, without us noticing that. That's what it is, unconscious and not conscious. So with this, we are not referring with unconscious, you've lost consciousness and you are thrown on the floor, fainted, but to something that is pretty active, pretty alive, but you're just unaware of that. And probably unwilling to be aware of that, as we will see, for some reasons. So I'm beginning today lecture again with this notion, not only in connection to the Kumar Lila that we touched at the end of the previous lecture, but also because I consider that we as a tradition, we should be open and willing to learn, not only from our own tradition, not only from other mystical traditions, but even from contemporary secular, if you will, disciplines like science, history, and psychology, especially, I would say, especially psychology, and enrich our own practice through their findings. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm starting by quoting Jung on the notion of the unconscious. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying this because sometimes devotees will think, oh, that's secular, so if something is secular, it's non-divine. So psychology is not necessarily Maya, just in case. No, it's a very interesting way of acknowledging and healing and dealing with our inner landscape and finding tools and ways of detecting the different things that need to be addressed in our bhakti project. So we should not only learn from these disciplines like psychology, history, etc., sociology, but we should also understand that our ancient wisdom traditions may need to be explained today, nowadays, in the context of contemporary science, human developments, again, especially psychology, I would say, you know, that for many it came to be considered like the handmaiden of theology in nowadays, psychology. So I would not only say that we need to understand our tradition through psychological lens in many cases, but also I will say that we as a tradition may need psychology. We as a tradition may need to do therapy, family therapy, as a sampradaya. There are many dysfunctional elements that need to be addressed. And we need to confront our unconscious as a collective. And so we can reach a new level of harmony, harmony collective, for those over there in Michigan. So in this way, Jung will speak about, when he speaks about unconscious, just a technical clarification, he will speak about two types of unconscious. Already the unconscious, the notion of unconscious is challenging enough, but he'll say what we have two. Individual unconscious, but also he will speak about the collective unconscious in the individual. So we can also speak about these two unconscious in relation not only to us and individuals, but also in relation to us as a collective, to the sampradaya. So of course, by individual unconscious, you imagine what's that? Some things that you have in your own unconscious, you have acquired in previous through previous impressions, and it's lying in some storehouse there that you cannot see where it is, basically, but it's informing your movements. But the part of the unconscious mind, which is derived from ancestral memory, in the words of Carl Jung, and experience, and which is common to all humankind, that's what, and it's distinct from the individual's unconscious, that's what's called the collective unconscious. So when we say here like an unconscious derived from ancestral memory and experience, and it's common to all humankind, here we say it's common to our lineage, to all the members of it. So that's, we can speak about the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So the question will be, of course, and that's the question of today's class, what's in the collective and in the individual unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya? What's hidden in the shed, as I like to define the unconscious sometimes, the bodega, sometimes they call it. What's there, hidden, unobserved, and unconsciously sometimes swept under the rough, because how painful it may be to acknowledge what's there. Sometimes we can call it our shadow. Which, as long as it remains there, remember, it's continuing to inform our movements, like it or not. So spiritual life is about becoming aware, becoming conscious. The very movement is called Krishna consciousness. But don't expect to become conscious of Krishna if first you are not willing to become conscious of all the things that are there in the unconscious. No? So Krishna is Krishna consciousness, it's not Krishna unconsciousness. So for Krishna consciousness, everything must be conscious. Now, everything that lies in the unconscious has to be properly dealt with so that it comes to the conscious platform. So that's Krishna consciousness. So, and here we get again another interesting term coming from Carl Jung in relation to the unconscious, which is the idea of the shadow. The shadow self, if you will. And so what's the shadow? And again, we will find parallels in our own tradition. We are not here just invoking heretic terminology that is completely divorced from our glossary or something like that. So the shadow has, as you may imagine already, the shadow has to do with those things about us again, both individually and collectively, that we don't want to see, basically, and that which, for all intents and purposes, we lose sight of them in our daily awareness. In our daily life, we are not aware of that section, of that shadow. And as you may imagine, this shadow is, of course, closely tied to the idea of the unconscious. You cannot separate, basically, one from the other. We are speaking about something that is informing every movement, almost, know it or not, like it or not. So if we are willing and sincere in our journey, we will be willing, open to become aware of those sections that we know are influencing us, but we are not aware of that. So probably that influence may not be the best, the most glorious one, the more graceful one. So how to deal with the shadow? How to deal with the unconscious? How to deal with this unseen force? How to bring that to the platform of proper awareness? So Jung invoked the term in that context, shadow work. How to deal with your shadow, that's what we will call shadow work, which somehow in our own Gaudiya terminology will be akin to the idea of anartha nivritti, I will say. Because anartha nivritti doesn't just mean some automatical consequence of your engaging in bhajan and kriya. It's not that you just practice and automatically all the anarthas go away and you just attain the glory of divine love eventually. But you have to become aware of the anarthas as much as you can, be willing to acknowledge your shadow while you are engaging in bhajan and kriya, while you are engaging in bhakti. That's anartha nivritti, not only the result of my bhajan and kriya, but the awareness of the anarthas that I'm dealing with in this particular stage of my practice. So anartha nivritti involves a willingness to become aware of the forces and influences that somehow are getting in the way of my present practice. So anartha nivritti, again, doesn't only mean purification of my heart, but an awareness of all those obstacles. And the obstacles will be, some of them will be conscious. I'm sure we all have very clearly some obstacles on the conscious platform, but there are many, or most of them are in the unconscious. So of course, you may not have a clue which are those obstacles, so that implies a willingness to bring that shadow to the forefront, that unconscious to the conscious, to have the bravery, the courage to do so. That's anartha nivritti also, to engage in your bhajan and kriya with that boldness. So that's also another way of speaking about shadow work, to ascertain what needs to be ascertained. So I'm practicing in a realistic way. I'm not practicing just having my own idea of which anarthas do I have to deal with and so on. So without shadow work, without a clear understanding of it to begin with, of the necessity of it, of what's that, many of us can very easily fall prey of different forms of evasiveness or what's sometimes called spiritual bypassing. Because again, we have so many nice paraphernalia in our devotional world that you can employ all these divine concepts, but just to avoid facing the shadow. Because there are so many nice things, even in the conscious platform, that are worthy of glorification, and that's great, but let's not use those glorious things in our conscious platform to avoid facing the shadow, when it's clear that it's required, that shadow work. So let's not employ divine concepts to avoid facing the shadow, to avoid facing pending emotional issues that are getting in the way, psychic wounds, unfinished developmental tasks, so many things. And of course, when I invoke the idea of shadow and shadow work, we may start to tremble a little bit. It may be a little intimidating, because one of the most terrifying things for most of us is to face this shadow. Because we are terribly ashamed of that. In most of our cases, we are full of guilt and shame and terror of actually acknowledging how miserable we are, how limited we are, how conditioned we are. Most of us don't have the capacity to be vulnerable deeply. We are afraid of that. We are still over-identified with them. So So for most of people, it's terrifying. One of the most terrifying things is to accept yourself completely, basically. And facing the shadow is part of accepting who you are now. Although eventually that won't be part of your Siddha Deha in Golok. But first you have to have a sense of personality which is relatively properly integrated. So that implies integrating your shadow. Shadow is not to be like denigrated, but integrated, if you will. So, but again, for us it's terrifying to accept ourselves completely. Mm. So because of that, shadow work can be particularly scary for a captive soul, for a conditioned soul, because it implies to expose what we could call the only enemy that actually exists, which is our false self, our ego, which of course will make the whole system of illusory life collapse. And we may say, yeah, we want that, but we have to see how much we want that in practice, the moment of truth. How much we are not still attached to it, clinging onto those ideas and notions, constructing, sustaining our life on that idea. And because ego has to do with control. Ego has to do with, as we always speak, with being in charge. In order to survive, the ego needs to do things. The false ego needs to keep in control, keeps in charge. I mean, think that it's keeping in control and in charge. And of course, conversely, it hates change. it hates remolding. It hates recalibrating stuff because that's the contrary of change, of control and false sense of control again. So again, all these things are happening in our shadow work, and we need to bring down them to light more and more. So for the shadow to be what it is, a shadow, by definition, also, it must be a part of us that we are totally ashamed of. So that's why we don't want to look in that direction. We don't want to even acknowledge its existence because it's so embarrassing. And interestingly enough, many spiritual traditions, if not most, have historically denied the shadow in almost all respects. I mean, I'm not saying every single member, but officially, in the way most people conducted themselves, that's not a very popular idea, I can tell you. Because, again, actually, interestingly, a spiritual tradition is supposed to teach us how to embrace the shadow, how to deal with it. But in many cases, they have told us how to attack the shadow, to attack those things that we are ashamed of, to hide them, not to speak about them, to confess them with guilt. All these types of, if you will, prescriptions, but not to integrate the shadow, not to embrace it, not to acknowledge it, not to learn from it, but just attack it, kill it, hide it, confess it. It's bad. So whatever may be the case, if you just attack it or think that's bad and let's try to kill it, the shadow remains in control. It's not that you are if you are not integrating the shadow, the shadow just keeps becoming bigger, probably, and remains an operative and very powerfully influence in our life, in our daily life. And the more you evade the shadow and hide it, the more you lose the capacity to acknowledge it, and the more it sits in control, and you become just like a puppet of your shadow. And that's one of the biggest spirit impediments in our to our spiritual growth. I mean, if you are really concerned with spiritual growth, we should know one of the biggest impediments is that we do not perceive our hidden motivations. And that's one of the main obstacles. And many times we feel there's an obstacle, I'm not advancing, and we don't know why. Probably because you are not seeing your hidden motivations, and probably because you are not willing to see them. Which is another layer. Again, you may not see them, and it's okay. It's your shadow, it's your unconscious. By definition, it has to be unseen. But how willing we are to confront that, to acknowledge, to see that. So we need to be taught to develop the bravery of exposing ourselves with full vulnerability to be properly enlightened and empowered to deal with that. Because if not, if we end up officially extending a massive pattern of denial to every single member of a community, teaching them to exist, as live as if the shadow does not exist, or to demonize the shadow, if you will. Let's not be surprised if you put many members with that type of pattern, put all of them together, a global entity eventually will emerge, and each tradition personifies a global entity, and you will have a whole community, a whole global entity that has acquired its own, again, shadow, its own unconscious as an entity, as a group, because of so many individuals being in that particular same frequency. And again, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it is said that it appears in the world as an event. No. Why that happened in the world? Well, go to the subconscious of the individuals through which the event happened, if you will. So it's an important point. When an inner situation is not made conscious, I repeat, it happens in the world as an event. It's not that the subconscious is operating and nothing happens, nobody. Somehow it appears. Maybe you cannot relate one thing to the other, but that's the byproduct of unaddressed shadow, if you will. One event after the other in the world, in your community, in your life. So how conscious we are of the unconscious? That's the question. How much we have avoided facing the details of our own human history as a community. I'm speaking here to Gaudiya Vaishnavas here. How willing we actually are to recognize, for example, our wounded side as a family, or our brokenness as a tradition. Again, there are many beautiful things. I'm not forgetting them. Especially because I see them, I'm asking these questions to bring them to special glory. But how much we are willing to be vulnerable and acknowledge that side. It's not here only about, let's talk about the upsides of my tradition and the downsides of every other tradition. No? Sometimes some people think that means instilling faith. No? Just an overdose of kijais and hiding whatever is not a kijai, throw that to the shed, into the unconscious. No, we should be willing to see the upsides of other traditions and also embrace the downsides of our tradition. Oh, everything has to be included and embraced in the equation. So how successful have we been as a tradition in withdrawing the projection of our own shadow into others, into other people, other members in the tradition, outside of the tradition? How much we are still trying to hide our own collective shadow by insisting, as I say, on an excessive praise of those things which are indeed glorious, but which stop being glorious when you start to use them as anxiolytics. Basically, you follow. Our tradition is full of glory, but if you use that glory as an excuse to hide your shadow, you are taking those glories as pills to relieve you from your anxiety, an anxiolytic, like a pill. So that's not real praise, that's not real seva, that's exploitation of the glories of your sampradaya. So we are not here for that, just in case. That doesn't mean to be a member of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And again, if something is clear to be there, because sometimes, again, what to speak of the unconscious, sometimes we are conscious of things that need to be changed, and we are not doing anything. We are just passively witnessing that, and that's a sin of omission. Now, you have the sin of commission, which means you do something that you know it's wrong, and you do it. That's called sin of commission. You are committing it. And then you have sin of omission, which means you let something bad happen, when you could have done something to stop it, but you just remain a passive, mediocre witness. So, and generally, popularly, the sin of commission is classically regarded as more serious than the sin of omission, than avoidance. But is that actually the case? I don't think so. Sin of omission can be very delicate. And it all starts in our own inner landscape again. Those things that to begin with, we see, we know they are wrong, and we don't do anything about it. What to speak of what's unconscious? Today we're speaking about the unconscious, of course, but first we have to work with the things that are on the conscious platform and deal with them properly. And again, all it starts individually and gradually extends to the global. Thomas Merton, my dear Thomas Merton, he will speak sometimes of the inseparability, you say, of our own healing journeys and the healing journeys of these different systems in the world. There are so many groups and systems in the world, but they are not separable from our own healing journeys. So our own healing journey is part of the healing of the whole world, in this case of the whole Gaudiya Sampradaya. So in this context, as part of the, of course, concept of radical personalism, we are personalizing, if you will, or giving one identity to the Sampradaya. And the Sampradaya is seeing it as a personalized entity. As part of our own individual experience, we are members of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And indeed, there are different social theories which propose this idea that any grouping of people is more than the sum of its parts. It's not just a group, it's many individuals put together. But it is a group is a system with its own life, an entity, if you will, in many ways, like a person also. So there is a place for us to think about the Gaudiya Sampradaya as an entity unto itself. So in this connection, let's try to make that exercise of conceiving the Gaudiya Sampradaya as a person, like we did when we spoke about its Kumar Lila in the last class, you know, a person going through that particular stage. So if the Gaudiya Sampradaya is in a particular stage as a person, in the same way that we as individuals may have some unresolved trauma from the past, and we may first need to acknowledge that, to address it, to heal it, to be in a better shape in the present moment. So in the same way, we could ask ourselves the same in relation to the personality, if you will, of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So which are those unresolved past traumas that have not been properly acknowledged yet in our Sampradaya, and therefore solved, and that are affecting at present our Sampradaya? Because whatever you have not solved from the past is affecting defining your present. So which are those things that are hidden in the unconscious of our tradition, in the shade, in the shadow, in the shed, sorry. And again, whatever it's not properly addressed from the past, it's the influence of that is shaping our present. And if it's shaping our present, it's shaping our future. So let's reflect together about that. This is the exercise, the conversation we are trying to have in this series. Now, this series is not so much me speaking to you and instructing the world or being posing as a teacher. It's me approaching all of you in the spirit of having a conversation. Although it may seem that it's me the only one speaking, but of course, that's in the spirit of extending ideas so we can continue evolving this conversation and in introspection, enter into an introspective space and together think about who we are, where we are, what do we want to be. And that collective introspection, I will say, is probably one of the highest forms of worship and one of the highest forms of communion. Although externally there may be not ritual or not specific form, but the spirit of the togetherness, that's one of the greatest yajñas. That's Sankirtan also. Don't also only think of Sankirtan as bring kartals, mridanga, and as only Sankirtan. What means Sankirtan? Sam means collective, indicates group. And Kirti means fame. So we are collectively getting together, Sam. We are engaging in yajna, Harinam Sankirtan yajna. Yajna means sacrifice. Sacrifice means enter the fire. Fire means tapa. Tapa means turn inwards. Like with Brahma here, tapa means look inside, be introspective. Tapa means introspection. So we are engaging in that fire of sacrifice, of introspection, by getting together and thinking how to better spread the fame of our tradition. Fame means kirti, kirtan. Kirtan has to do with fame, with spreading the fame or the glories of a tradition. So for that, we need to sit together, to be introspective, to enter that particular fire. And all that is defined as Sankirtan. If you don't have the type of introspection, your Sankirtan is just musical entertainment. It's not mystical, it's musical at best. So again, it all starts in our own hearts. That's what we are inviting here. That's our one of the many forms of Sankirtan. So on this reflection, this introspection can be developed in communion with others. I mean, we can think by ourselves, but we need each other. It's a social phenomenon. Sankirtan is essentially a social phenomenon. Sankirtan, by its very definition, Sankirtan means you cannot do it by yourself. You can do Sankirtan, as I like to say sometimes. You can do some Kirtan yourself. You pick a kartal and use some Kirtan. But Sankirtan, you need others. We need each other to engage in Sankirtan. We need each other to engage in this collective sacrifice, if you will. Mm-hmm. So this is what we are trying to do here. Mm-hmm. Trying to think together about how to best serve our ideal. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, some first initial words in connection to the notion of the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya and how we are being invited to work, to do that shadow work. And let's continue, of course, in the same line regarding how we need, as part of our shadow work, how we need to embrace our wounds so those wounds don't embrace our next generation. Mm-hmm. So we need to do something with our wounds as individuals and tradition so we are not passing that like inheritance to the next generation for them to solve them, to put them as an extra luggage to whatever they already have. So this group reflection, again, this introspection that we are defining as Sankirtan, it's giving ourselves, how to say, each other, it requires bravery and courage, and sometimes we need others to also like push us in that direction, to enter, to unearth our Gaudiya collective unconscious. I mean, that may feel dangerous. You have to enter into an agasura or something, if you will. It seems so, like this. So we need some courage. So in this unearthing of our own collective unconscious, we may find some painful things, painful stuff that first need to be accepted before that's healed, again, even. Mm-hmm. But we need to develop that, and we need to develop some strong strength regarding recovering from whatever has happened in the past at present. You know, sometimes that's called resilience. Resilience. Mm-hmm. So resilience means this capacity to recover from what happened in the past. When we go to the past and when we will see what happened there, how to continue our life without being frozen by the past. So that's resilience. And that resilience also includes, of course, for us to be resilient, it means recover from the past. First, I need to recognize what happened in the past. What I need to recover from. Because if not, I cannot even start to speak about resilience. So we need to be willing to enter into that direction. And there may be pain, but it's okay. Pain is necessary also in the equation of life. Failure is necessary. Failure, suffering, sometimes they have been defined as like the greatest equalizers and levelers among humans. Those experiences so make us sober, help us to get a glimpse of reality in a more realistic way. And many times, interestingly, success is the exact opposite of that. When you have too much success, you get intoxicated and you get completely out of context with reality, while failure and suffering ground you, settle you. If you analyze even historically, socially, there are lots of communities, and commitment around those communities can form much more easily around suffering than around how wonderful or superior we are or we think we are. You won't find very successful communities around that, but around suffering and pain, and people who get together committed to that's a fact. I mean, that's there in the research, if you will. So suffering is there to make us greater in the good sense of the term. Nietzsche will say that in his famous book, Beyond Good and Evil. He will say, I speak about the discipline of suffering. I mean, we are not promoting masochism, but the discipline of suffering, he will say, of great suffering even, not just suffering, but great suffering. He will say, do you know that only this discipline has created all enhancements of man so far? Like you take away suffering from human history and probably you're taking away all the great attainments in human civilization, in big part at least. So suffering is having a purpose there. So don't develop some rejection mechanism toward that. Mm-hmm. Another way of speaking about this, and again, all this is getting putting together ideas so we don't are afraid to enter into that shed and to deal with that unconscious, to recognize our wounds. In the secular world, there is one concept called transformational conflict. So the idea is conflict basically is there to transform you. It's not something bad. It's something to embrace so we can be untransformed. And the idea is that a crisis is like a veiled opportunity, like to redefine, to reestablish a higher standard of relationship with everything, sambandha, for all involved. Of course, first, for letting the crisis transform you, first you have to acknowledge that there is a crisis. And remember, the word crisis is not a bad word. That's when we spoke about what shines in the darkness. Crisis means turning decisive point. So that's great. Of course, that's scary if you don't want to be responsible or you are afraid of being free because you have to take responsibility. But crisis is a great portal. Turning decisive point. So first we have to acknowledge the crisis. And only then we can learn to mourn and weep over the crisis in a proper way before we try to solve it comprehensively. So we shouldn't skip any of these stages. So crisis is not a bad word. Probably crisis has some root with Christ, Krishna, you never know. So we need to, again, we don't need to escape from problems, from pain. We need to embrace that, to weep about that properly, integrate that, and eventually that will become a part of our enhanced situation. So this weeping that we are speaking about here actually could be seen as a middle point, and it's important, these middle points, between blaming and denying. No? When a problem knocks your door, no? You may deny the problem, or you may acknowledge the problem, but find immediately some outside enemy to blame. And those are two extremes, totally undesirable. The middle point between blaming and denying is weeping. Like acknowledging the situation, taking responsibility, lamenting in a healthy way, integrating the pain, the wound, and growing. That's the idea. No? Make some use of your wounds. Now, the wounds are not there to be healed as soon as possible, but to heal you. And not necessarily as soon as possible. That may take time. So don't be in a rush. No? When this wound is healing, when it's finished, and hopefully no scars are there. Some scars. Not necessarily. No, maybe the wound has to remain there for some time to teach you something. So we have to be open to that. We have to grow to understand these things. No? And I'm saying this to me. I'm talking about this, but of course, how you understand them and leave them inside, there is no limit to that. So there's so much more to do. So we should be able to use our wounds to redeem ourselves. Try to think in that way. To redeem ourselves and to redeem others around us. So if there is pain in our past, in our history, as individuals, as tradition, let's use of that as a redemption tool, if you will. Do not weaponize your pain, basically, through the various tones of victim consciousness. We are not about that. Now, when pain comes, that's the option. You can become a victim. You can weaponize your pain and start to demonize everyone around you. Or you can become a hero in the proper sense of the term and redeem yourself and others through the wound. So we should learn to embrace the wound, as I'm saying. So we don't make others have to embrace that in future generations. Like a parent, if a parent, a father, mother are not properly dealing with their own thing, they are passing it on to their children. And that becomes a generational trauma, basically. And so we need to embrace the wound. And then after we embrace the wound, we acknowledge it, what may be unsolved in our unconscious, then we can sit and cry for what it is, from the wound as it is. As part of our healing process, the weeping is part of the healing process. And again, with Gaudi, as we may define our tradition as a tradition of tears. There are so many tears in our tradition, so many ecstatic saints crying and lamenting in divine separation. But before attempting that, and that's not something you can just like an attempt. Okay, I will try to attempt not doing it like Raghunath Das Goswami, whatever. You cannot attempt to sit and cry in separation from our beloved Krishna. But before even attempting that, or before reaching that, first we must learn to invoke another set of tears, if you will. So which is that? Let's cry for those wounds, which need to be taken into account, both individually and collectively. And through that cried wound, if you want to call it like that, through that, let's gain full access to the next stage we as a community need to enter, whatever that may be. So we can advance through crying, through weeping. That's our vehicle. Through that water, that will be advanced in a fluid way, carried by a sea of tears, according corresponding tears to each particular stage. So remember, wounds don't need to be healed. Wounds are there to heal us. Allow that to happen. Allow your way of thinking to allow that paradox. As counterintuitive as it may sound, it makes sense on a deeper level. So I feel that we as a tradition, we Gaudiyas need to be further thought about all this, about entering into that space, which seems dark, which seems embarrassing, which seems to the ego, no, weak, all this stuff. We would like more to think in terms of going up. But before going up, we need to go down. No? Before ascending, we have to descend, if you will. So I think we as Gaudiyas, we need to be taught more about not so much the language of ascent, no, going up, meritocracy. I'm doing and chanting my 16 rounds, following my four regs. Golok is waiting for me there. But we should be taught more about the language of descent, as some will call it. Entering into that shadow land, if you will. And to enter willingly, trustingly, into those dark periods of life. I mean, to have the courage to embrace that. Again, these dark periods are good friends, are good teachers. They are not monsters. We may feel them as monsters, but that's our own filter. So, in other words, these situations like this, problematic situation, critical situation, whatever it may be, things to be solved, are inviting us to grow. So how can they be a monster? And what's that grow? Again, part of that growth, you may have heard me say this 108 times this last month, means to you learn to coexist with all these paradoxes, with these counterintuitive ideas, darkness, uncertainty, the unknown, but trust that Krishna is in control above all that. So entering willingly with that deep trust, basically. So we as community need to develop this like collective courage and enter there. If we as a community avoid that, avoid transfiguring our sorrow and reshaping it into whatever, an integrated, more mature vision, again, we may end up transmitting our undigested heartaches or something. Not only to our immediate peers, we will transmit that, our frustration and our pain, undigested pain, but especially we will transmitting all that stuff to the next generation. And that's not the idea. The duty of present generation is to allow the future generations to deal with their own corresponding traumas, not to pass one's own unresolved trauma to others and to add them to their own already complex baggage. That's not gentle. That's not very kind for your for your children, if you will, as a parent or whatever. So in our present times, there is a clear emergency, I don't know how to call it, but let's say emergence, through which I've seen younger generations of Gaudiya Vaishnavas expressing their unwillingness to swallow the generational trauma of their progenitors, let's say like that. I'm not saying that the progenitors are passing out with bad intention, but just even unconsciously, because so many of this is in the unconscious. Because again, the younger generations have their own generational trauma to deal with. So they will say, why you are throwing on me your own generational trauma? That's yours. You need to solve it yourself. That's not parampara. Again, the Sanskrit term parampara refers to the passing down of wisdom, knowledge, revelation, insight, and new revelations always from one generation to another. And the system becomes updated and upgraded by each member. Parampara doesn't mean passing unresolved trauma to your descendants. But sometimes that's happening in the name of parampara. And that's embarrassing. So, you follow my point. Even in that sense, we could say that any wisdom that is imparted through parampara should ideally be, at least partly, the result of one's resolved traumas, not unresolved traumas. So what I'm giving to you is the result of my resolved traumas in the form of wisdom and insight, so you can receive my resolved trauma to deal with your unresolved trauma, and not throw on you my unresolved trauma, so your unresolved trauma becomes even more unresolved. No, that's not parampara. So parampara means, again, the result of your own resolved trauma, your acquired experience and maturity, which is extended to younger representatives, so they are better equipped to tackle and integrate their own generational issues, and so on. So we should be concerned with that, you know, what we are doing as a sampradaya, what we are passing on to the next generation. You have to be thinking about those things, not just about you and what's going on now. But please, then, let's not be so selfish, so narrow-minded. So we should be, there's one term by Erik Erikson, which is the generative person. Generative person is not someone who generates stuff, producers. But generative means someone concerned with the next generation. No. So the person is not just concerned with me, myself, here and now, but with others, and not only now, but in the future. And for that, I'm traveled to the past. So that person says to be living in what's sometimes called deep time. No, they are not just in the present, in their own small time, in my own small bubble of what's going on around me. But that person is living in past, present and future all at once. They are in the present, but they are learning from the past. They are living in the present, and they are concerned about the future. So they don't lose sight of any of the three phases of time. And they're working from that place. That means a generative person, concerned with the other generations, the future, but also with the past and the present. So it's from this unique generative position that we can actually generate whatever changes we need to invoke today. In a fearless voice, in a fresh voice, with the boldness and with the creativity and originality, I will say, that so much characterize our glorious ancestry, if you will, our past acharyas. They spoke with that type of voice. Fearless voice, bold voice, but also creative, humble, original, brave, loving. So we should be brave, compassionate, empathic, everything at the same time when speaking this, like Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say in his last, almost his very last words, speaking, inspiring his followers to speak akaitava satya kata, which means speak always the truth, free from all types of cheating, following this idea of dharma prajita kaitava from the Bhagavatam. So he stressed this, with great enthusiasm and in a fearless voice, always speak the truth. And truth means full truth, not half truth, three quarters truth, but full truth, full blown, full fledged. So that's how we should do. I mean, we should not be whimsically criticizing what others are doing. But we should also stop being so afraid of breaking rules that made perfect sense in the distant past, but are no longer sustainable today. So we should, instead, we should fear repeating the failures of the past and present it and present in the uncertain future. I mean, we should be fearful of that. Again, what we are giving to our next generation. So as I say, with the same, we should show the same creativity, freshness, boldness in our time that our ancestors expressed in their time. So we should wonder what shape creativity, boldness, freshness have to take today for us to continue honoring their legacy. So we shouldn't merely tend the thumbs of the prophets, as they say. We should become prophets ourselves, as we spoke already. That's radical personalism. So anyhow, some words regarding this idea of embracing our wounds so we are not passing them to next generation, to the next generations. So let's enter this, the last section of today's talk. Thank you for bearing with me. Which, of course, in this connection also, some words about orienting our practice in a positive way, in a constructive way, and being present in the present, but concerned properly about past and future as well. So again, we do, if we want that the movement grows, our movement Gaudiya Sampradaya grows, expands, I hope you say yes, but I hope that you also understand that the growth is not necessarily in terms of physical size and numbers. That the movement grows means that your heart has to grow. The more your heart is growing, the more the Gaudiya Sampradaya is growing. Because what's the meaning of growing in numbers but not growing in heart? Oh, that's a joke. Mahaprabhu is not requesting numbers. No, he's requesting transformed hearts, basically. So the more your heart is growing, the more the movement is growing. Because the headquarters of the Gaudiya Sampradaya are in your heart. Yeah, are not in Vrindavan, in Puri, in India, in the United States. The headquarters are beating in your heart. That's the beating headquarters of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So the more the movement, your heart is growing, and try to make parallel in your mind every time I say the movement means your heart. The movement is growing in the way that it has to actually grow. And again, that's in quality first. Quantity will follow us whatever form it has to take. So it's all about quality. It's not so much about what to believe, but how to believe. So that's quality. Again, we must move from a belief-based religion, which is more dogmatic, and it's about what to believe, which are the correct set of thoughts, what I'm supposed to say, how to be politically correct, what's the correct way of doing everything. We must move from there, from a belief-based religion to an experience-based religion, to a deep experiential thing, which is not so much about what to believe, had the correct sets of beliefs in place, but how to believe. How to believe the beliefs, if you will. Because if not, little will change. And again, belief doesn't mean only do I believe in God or not, but so many beliefs that even many of us carry as Gaudiyas, which in many cases are myths more than beliefs. Beliefs that we may not have experience of, we just believe in them. So how to make them experiential? But again, for many, Gaudiya Vaishnavism today has become a belief system, basically. So you fit in, or you think you belong, but it's more fitting in, by having the proper beliefs, by knowing what to say, what not to say. And that's very different of having a full lifestyle, of Gaudiya Vaishnavism being an all-encompassing, pervading aspect of every part of your day. So again, you have the right word. Jesus said in the famous Sermon of the Mount, like, oh, these people have all the right words, but no change of heart. So that can happen not only in the Mount, in that sermon. I mean, it speaks to all of us. You can have the right words. You can learn how to speak, how to give class, how to be charismatic and perfect, sedantically speaking. But if your heart is not changing, it's not moving, the Gaudiya Sampradaya is not expanding. So where's your heart beating for? So again, we need to have a positive life. This is a lifestyle, and the lifestyle has to be oriented in a positive way, because Gaudiya Sampradaya is so positive. Of course, again, we have spoken about embracing our shadow and acknowledging all the things that we may call not so positive, but also they are positive by properly dealing with them. So we are here not against anything. No, that's an important point. We are not starting here some anarchic movement to full of rage and full of let's kill everyone and let's criticize and speak against. And it's easier, unfortunately, for most of us, it's easier to be against something than to be for something. And unfortunately, many movements start out of that. Now, let's get together so we have, because we have a common enemy. So let's be against him, and we sense a sense of unity because of our common enemy. But we are here for something in a positive way. But again, it's frankly much easier to be against than to be for. And even on a doctrinal level, so much has to be presented in that way for lots of neti-neti in our tradition of rejection. To be again, that's Maya bad, this is bad. Every other religious expression is lower than ours. Karma is her bad, demons, asura, woman, gay, people, material world. No. Those who do not belong to my tribe. So many, we are against. We know what we are against for, of. Again, but when we are, someone asks, what are you for? Like I like to say, it's the four principles are not don'ts, are do's, are not to be against intoxication and to be against illicit stuff of whatever you may like to conceive. But it's to be for purity, for compassion, for and so on. And of course, these are a few of the various forms of what sometimes called oppositional thinking. That people may have. You think in terms of being opposed to something. No? I have to prove something, someone wrong to prove me right. That's the root issue behind all this. No? That you find easy to be against and to be for. Proving someone wrong makes me feel be right. Which, well, that's not the case, as you may imagine. And that's interestingly what characterizes an addict. No? An addict has this all or nothing thinking. There's not very much shades in between nuance. It's like an undisciplined mind, which is addict, doesn't mean addict to heroin or just all. I mean, you can be addict. All of us are addicts in so many levels. If your mind is not disciplined on that level, you're an addict probably. So an undisciplined mind will think in absolutes, always. All or nothing. Again, this is the best, this is the worst, this is good, bad. So if you are not on my side, basically that mind will think you're against me. If you do not fully agree with me, then you fully disagree with me. I cannot learn anything from you because I disagree with you on that particular point. So that makes you totally bad person, a wrong person. So in that sense, religion in general, and not only Gaudiya Vaishnavism, again, many of the things I'm saying probably may be applicable to any other tradition. Religion in general, in that sense, has stopped doing its job of teaching people how to live with contradictions. And paradoxes. Instead, they're training them in this hyper-dualistic either-or thinking. And of course, on a daily basis, we need to deal with contradiction in a more realistic way. We are facing dozens of unresolvable contradiction on a daily basis. It's not that contradiction happened once in a year. So if we are not taught how to deal with those daily issues, we will become very like constricted and very bitter human beings, which just think in terms of absolutes and live their life condemning others. And how do you live with darkness? Now that's the question. Instead of projecting the darkness always to outside so-called enemies. So we need to learn a few things in this connection. And again, I'm saying when I say we, the first member of that we is I. So just for you to know and for me to remember, because I can forget as well, and please you remind me. So again, we feel this strange thing that by seeing negative and criticizing others, I'm okay. There is something very, even we could say strangely sweet about negative accusatory feelings. No? There's some like forbidding madhurya there, like some sweetness that we feel very strangely. It's a strange way that you achieve moral superiority, basically. No, I feel right because someone else is wrong. Even if that person is not wrong, but you have to think he's wrong so you can feel right about yourself. Well, probably you are the one who is wrong. So, but that's interesting, no? But you are just right because someone else is wrong. You have not done anything to be right yourself, but the other is wrong, so I must be right because I disagree with him. And probably you are doing many things wrong, but the only way you have to justify them is showing how someone else is much more wrong than you. No? And of course, that also can happen. You can always find someone who is much more terrible. I'm not Hitler, no, if you will, but you are. You may be a potential Hitler. Who knows? If you are given the tools and the possibilities, you never know. We are units of potential in the direction of light and darkness. So that's the point. Sometimes you are only projecting your own wrongdoings onto the environment also. Sometimes there's nobody doing something wrong, but you are doing wrong, but you don't have the bravery to acknowledge that. And so you need someone else to be as wrong as you actually are, so you can rest and feel, oh, he's so wrong and I'm right. But that's not how it works. And again, I'm not talking only on the level of an individual, but sometimes our narrative as a community fits these categories. So we condemn whole groups. So we feel like, oh, we are not like them. Moral superiority. That's totally against Trinada Pisunichena, Mahaprabhu, the type of humility he's promoting. So we should be brave enough, adult enough, to embrace the truth without the need of creating enemies, to creating us and them structures, and accept whatever consequences of that will be, you know, by embracing the truth. Because if not, we get trapped into all these mind tricks and ideologies and, as someone called, ideological bunkers. And they are very toxic. I mean, they are worse than breaking all the four wrecks together, I would say. You know, the traps of mind, ideology. I mean, those are as toxic as blinding as the so-called hot sins. Not that some may call it. For us, breaking the four regulative principles. Sometimes we think that's the worst possible thing. No, to do the things that only drunkards and prostitutes will do. But actually, no. Toxic ideology is even worse. And those are harder to recognize because they are so subtle. You are not doing anything grossly, externally. Oh, he's not smoking, he's not drinking, he's not... But internally, you are inhabiting a much worse place than any brothel or... Like an example of that, no? For example, you may have an unresolved, unacknowledged trauma. Again, let's apply that to an individual and extend that to the global entity. We may have an unresolved, unacknowledged trauma from the past, and we may be unconsciously terrified of that shadow. So instead of facing our own fears, our own partialities created, that we create to provide a sense of security against so-called enemies that are not outside, you continue denying your shadow and projecting your own shadow onto others, and you feel constantly threatened of your own shadow embodied into people in front of you. And since you feel threatened, you feel in the need of attacking everyone. Not only attacking, but sometimes demonizing those who actually are embodying whatever you have not dealt with in your own unconscious. So we can do that as individuals. We can do that as devotees. We can do that as senior devotees. We can do that even as gurus. We can also do that as a collective. Again, the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So there is some need for repair. I hope you get my point. Because to be honest, in many ways our movement, and again, not only our movement, but we are talking about the Gaudiya Sampradaya, apart from all the wonderful, beautiful things the movement has created and make us being here together, speaking about this and hearing about this with healthy concern, also we should put in the scale how many ways the movement has created many, we may call, tragic gaps for any person who has an operative head and a beating heart. And I know that there are many of them, I can tell you. But there are tragic gaps in between this point. So if we do not acknowledge all this, we are creating this type of toxic pattern. Because if there is something that you need to change, but you then changed, and you haven't worked on that from day one, and it becomes a pattern of denial, day two, day three, no, not a pattern of recognition, as we say, a pattern of healing, of acknowledgement. So you have that pattern of denial, day one, day two, week one, month two. First, multiply the pattern for 4 or 5 decades, not only on individual level, but on a group level. There you have it. Trauma disguised as transmission of divine knowledge, basically. No, that's not parampara, I can tell you. Of course, I'm not saying with this that everything about parampara is happening in that way. I'm not saying that. But that may be happening. In the name of parampara, we may be just transmitted, throwing on others undigested trauma. Trauma disguised as transmission of divine knowledge. So be careful. At least on some level, I'm saying this, at least in some cases. I'm not absolutizing my statements. So please don't take them out of context. So in many cases, we haven't taught people how to transform. We have taught people how to transmit. Just know what to tell others, know how to give the class, know how to sell the book, know how to transmit. But first you have to transform. And you can only transmit what has been transformed. But sometimes it's not just transmit while belonging, quote-unquote belonging, to your particular tribe. So this is a tribe narrative. And that's what you have to say. And again, this is not belonging as we have been talking. Belonging is a deeper thing. You know? Fitting in is a superficial sense of belonging. Because sometimes when we think belonging, we think in terms of belonging to the right mission, belonging to the best guru, all in terms of ego validation, an ego trip, basically. But belonging has something to do with something else, as I like to make a play of words. No? Belonging has to do with, where is my inner longing? No? Where is my bee? No? As a longing. I have to be a bee. I have to become a bumblebee in longing. That's where I belong. No? When I be, when I am, when I transform myself in longing, there I belong. Belonging without that falls short. It's just fitting in or whatever. So your belonging is defined by your longing. As much as you become longing yourself, or you are belong, then proportionately to that, you actually belong in the most substantial way. Again, it's not about fitting in. It's about belonging deeply and transformed. Again, not just transmit. That's just tribe narrative. So let's conclude. Let's just reach the conclusion. We can continue, but we have to conclude at some point, at least for today, and we can continue then. We need to also continue thinking about this. But as a conclusion, let's try to make this it's a pressing question, but those are the questions we need to present to our own Gaudiya mind, or to our own Gaudiya mind, to the Gaudiya unconscious. Like, how do we get how ourselves to begin with, how do we get to the dogmas and doctrines that we believe in? How? What's the process for that? Now, is there a healthy way, or we are doing that in a toxic way? Because a dogma by itself is not changing people. I mean, just passing dogma is not transformative. There has to be something else along with that. Because again, if we give someone dogma, again, parampara is not throwing dogma to the next generation, or what to speak of throwing unresolved trauma. You can give dogma, you can be a doctrine and concept, but you have to give the people a mind to process that as well. If you just give something, but you are not teaching them how to, as we spoke last class, how to process that, that's not sambandha, full sambandha. You have to give the people the knowledge, but you have to give them the way of thinking to properly think about that, to understand that, to appreciate that. So the question is, are we just learning dogma without any transformative effect? And I think you all know the answer to that question. Simply learning the dogma, ask yourself, does simply learning dogma take us to transformation? Hopefully you say no. Carl Jung would also say, be aware of unearned wisdom. That's an interesting idea, very deep one. Be aware of unearned wisdom. So you can receive a very deep concept, wisdom, but you have to earn the wisdom. You have to not to deserve, again, because I'm not trying to invoke meritocracy here, but you have to work in such a way that wisdom is properly integrated. In that sense, you deserve it. So our Sampradaya has to give people the tools and the minds to know what to do with what parampara constitutes. But sometimes spiritual traditions, most of them, and ours is not an exception to the rule, many cases most spiritual traditions are not helping people to grow. Not all, again, I'm not saying not all, not everyone, but as a general template, that's happening. And to grow means to invite people to be transformed. To move past non-conformity, to move beyond group behavior, tribe narrative, to move beyond mere belief system, to move beyond this type of narrow belonging idea of narrow belongingness, and they should move people into the kind of inner freedom and love that I think we really need to see in the world today at large, I would say, and respond to everything that is happening around us. So again, passing dogma or even unresolved trauma is not parampara. Sometimes we need to speak strong about what something is not, to have a more clear idea of what that something is supposed to be. So I've spoken maybe for 20 years about what parampara is. Maybe give me a few months to speak about what that and other things are not. So we balanced the presentation. So basically that. No, we need therefore to think. We need to learn. Sorry, before saying we need to think. We need to learn to think. We need to learn to feel. We need to learn to talk at a higher level. At the level of wisdom. And that's a language that is inclusive. That's a language that is naturally universal. And with this, I'm not implying some forced New Agey stuff or anything. We are just speaking about a mature participation in mysticism, if you will, in any tradition, even including ours, of course, which is a mystical tradition. So real mature participation in our mystical school, this is not a tribal teaching. This is not an in-house teaching. This is universal, Sanatana Dharma. It's a message for everyone. We call it Sanatana Dharma. Sanatana Dharma is a completely universal idea. But it's not enough just to call it, no, Sanatana Dharma. We practice Sanatana. We must embody Sanatana Dharma from tip to toe. From tip to toe. Not only one of the tips, one of the toes. No. From tip to toe, embody Sanatana Dharma. And again, please don't forget, just before concluding, please don't forget, I'm saying each and every of these words and things because I love Gaudiya Vaishnavism, not because I leave Gaudiya Vaishnavism. This is not about me leaving or not us leaving Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but us loving Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And because I love it, it hurts me to see it being misrepresented, basically. And of course, again, the pain of misrepresentation starts at home by seeing my own misrepresentation of it on a daily basis in so many ways. And it's painful, and I have to learn to acknowledge that and to mourn and weep upon that, as I've been talking about. So again, whatever I'm sharing here with you applies first to the speaker. But again, if anything touches your heart, the headquarters of the Gaudiya movement, then let's make it all happen as much as we can in the service of these wonderful ideas that have been handed down to us and that continue to reach our hearts in so many ways. So anyhow, some thoughts today we want to share in the context of the collective unconscious of the Gaudiya Sampradaya and all that can be extracted from that, and not all, of course, just a little bit of that we share today. And we will conclude here. As a homework, if you would like to join us, because it's a collective work, Sankirtan, remember, collective reflection, not only during the class, but during the week, until the next class, and during each day, and during our life. Let's reflect on individually, but also as a group, knowing that others are reflecting along with you. Which are the things that you feel? Let's take personal responsibility. Which things you think should change? You feel should change, can change in the present situation of our Sampradaya, and begin changing them in your own situation on a level that you can start without being overwhelmed, but it's not sustainable. So try to develop that type of commitment with the idea. Okay, what should be changed? What should change? Because we can be speaking about that all day. But what can, in a realistic way, what can we do with to start that change or to continue with that change? What can I do today here to make my contribution and do it? So it's not just about words, or it's just not about even constructive criticism, because constructive criticism implies a commitment to action. So anyhow, that will be today's homework, and gradually, hopefully, the topic of today's lecture will extend, accompany us this week and overflow in the next week's lecture. So next class, next week, the title, or basically the idea, will be reasons to live, to remain, sorry, or live as a Gaudiya Vaishnav, in connection to what we are talking. And again, make it clear, we're not promoting anyone to leave. But we'll be considering reasons that may pop up in everyone's mind, why to remain or why not to remain, and what to do with that, what to do with the answer to those questions, so we can continue in the most substantial way. So we'll leave here. If you have any questions or comments, as usual, I invite you to share them in the threads, corresponding threads in Facebook or YouTube. So we also, it's another way of continuing throughout the week, sharing and continue this Sankirtan or collective introspection and reflection. Sri Gaudiya Sampradaya ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrind ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bo, Vancha Kalpataru Vishya Kripa Sindhu Vyai Vacha, Patitanam Pavanipyo Vaishnavipyo Namo Nama, Ananta Kuti Vaishnava Vrind ki jai, Gaur Gaur Hari Bo.